On the Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that some may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Paul Holes.
And I'm Billy Jensen. Welcome to the Murder Squad. Minot, North Dakota. The population a decade ago was 41,000. One out of every six adults works at the Air Force Base. There's also Minot State University, where Anita Knutson just finished her freshman year. She was majoring in education and juggled three part-time jobs.
It was the summer of 2007. Anita was alone in her apartment when a killer entered the home. Her father would find Anita's body on June 4th. She had been stabbed to death. The murder weapon was left at the scene, along with a lot of other evidence. But they yielded no answers. Our job, to find Anita's killer.
This is the Murder Squad.
All right, Billy. You're looking a little distracted right now.
Well, you know what? It's finally Christmas time. Oh, holiday time.
Okay.
And my favorite Christmas show I purchased, and now I have it forever on Amazon, Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas. Have you ever seen Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas by Jim Henson?
I have never even heard of it.
It very well might be the most amazing thing, not just for Christmas, just for anything. It's about an otter whose father has died, and he lives with his mom, and there is a big sort of talent contest.
Okay.
And he joins it in order to, he wants to win to get his mother a piano. She joins it to get him a guitar, and he busts her wash tub in order to make a wash tub bass. He sells his toolbox in order to make a dress, and then they lose the talent show. I'm giving a spoiler alert right now, but it's one of the most amazing puppet performances ever by something called the River Bottom Nightmare Band. Such a great metal band, and made up of fish and snakes and things. This is it right here. I want you to take a look at it.
So
you see that?
Oh, hold on.
We would play you the music for it, but we don't want to get sued by Jim Henson / Disney.
So it does have
Kermit is the
so Muppets is that? That's right, Muppets.
Is
that right?
Really? That's right. Muppets? Yes, yeah. Muppets. How do you not know Muppet? You know Muppets.
I actually have a Henson connection if you want to play a snippet of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe we will.
I'm not going to promise that it'll make
okay.
it
so,
on air.
So Kermit the Frog, right? And Miss Piggy and the old
yes,
men.
But they're not the old men. Yeah, Statler and Waldorf. But they're not in this one. Kermit actually is just sort of almost kind of like the narrator a little bit. He's just introducing it. So they would have a familiar face.
Yeah.
But it's all brand new characters. There's also a... It's so good. It's so heartfelt. I remember when my dad was sick and he went to the hospital for heart surgery when I was like 14, it was just me and my mom. And I remember, there's a part in the show where he goes out and gets a Christmas branch because, that's what their dad used to do because he never had the heart to just chop down a whole tree. So I remember that year because everything was so crazy in my house. And, you know, my dad used to also set up this amazing Christmas display. And we actually had to put up a sign that says, due to illness, there's no Christmas display this year because people would come from miles around to come see it. And I remember going outside in my backyard and cutting off a Christmas branch and then putting it in the living room. And that's what we had for Christmas. So, this is very much my, one of my, favorite shows, and I just purchased it.
Well, actually, I'm kind of blown away that you know the two old men's names.
Statler and Waldorf.
Statler and Waldorf?
Yeah, they're American treasures.
Oh, I mean, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, my favorite Christmas show, I actually have one, believe it or not.
All right.
You know, my heart isn't always just coal or whatever, and so...
My heart isn't always just cold. Can we get an illustrator on that ASAP?
But it's one of the Rudolph ones. One of the, you know, the what do they call it? The stop motion
yes.
Rudolph. And it's the one with is it Mr. Freeze and
Heat Miser, Cold Miser?
Exactly, where they do the dancing back and forth, yes. and they have the mom, you know, Mother Earth or whatever. That's my all time favorite, right there.
Yeah, those Rankin Bass stuffs were. There's a lot of for people that said they didn't take drugs. It's a lot of drugs. Type stuff there, but yeah, no,
well,
wonderful.
Don't blow it for me.
I don't make I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
All right, put the call back in your heart.
Yeah.
But yeah, so if you, yeah, I would go if you're going to watch that. I do love that. I do love Baby New Year too. Is also wonderful. Having a
is that the one with the whale?
Yes, I believe it is the one with the whale. Yeah,
okay.
That's a good one. And the mouse with the Night Before Christmas one, which is a cartoon one. I always like that one as well. But you know what? You have puppets singing heavy metal songs. Gets me every time.
Well, I'm good with the metal. I might have to. What is that band called?
All right, the band is called River Bottom Nightmare Band.
Okay.
And we might have to cut this out, but I do want to. I'm going to play it.
I just need to hear it. Even
I
just
love that
snippet.
You guys are just talking like kid movies, and I'm like, Miracle on 34th Street would be my favorite.
No.
The original, yeah. Natalie Wood, Maureen O'Hare.
No. You know what? All right, well, Die Hard then.
Fuck that.
Now, Die Hard, I can get on. That
one's
good.
Not a Christmas movie.
All right, here we go.
I disagree.
God bless Jim Henson. Okay. All right, Paul, let's go to North Dakota.
So, in Minot, North Dakota, home to the Minot State University Beavers, where 18-year-old Anita Knutson was in between her freshman and sophomore years. Anita was majoring in early childhood education. According to her family, Anita always fought for the underdog and was a friend to everyone. Her sister said she never met anyone she didn't like. Anita, her little sister Anna, and her brother Daniel were adopted by the Knutsons as very small children. They had a strong bond and were always in contact. That's why on the weekend of June 2nd, her family began to worry when they couldn't reach her. On top of them not being able to track Anita down, she also didn't show up for work that Saturday. The family lived an hour from where Anita was living with her roommate at an off-campus apartment. After 2 days of not being able to hear Anita's voice, her father, Gordon, made the drive to check on her.
Her father got to Anita's apartment on 4th Street, but the door was locked. He repeatedly tried to get someone to come to the door, but when no one did, he hunted down the building manager. And the manager didn't want to get into any trouble for letting him in, and while they discussed the issue, a maintenance guy pointed out a troubling sight. The screen to Anita's bedroom window was lying on the ground. Above it, the window open. And her father, Gordon, looked inside and saw Anita's lifeless body on the bed. He could actually reach in and touch her, and she was cold despite the summer temperatures. Then the manager opened the door.
Every father's nightmare right there.
Inside, the apartment didn't appear disheveled. That is until you reached Anita's bedroom. There, Anita was on the bed face down, and blood covered the bed and parts of the floor. She'd been stabbed multiple times, and her body was haphazardly covered with a robe. Detectives looked around the apartment and noticed items of value were in plain sight. Nothing looked to be missing. Everything that was supposed to be there was there. But when they walked into the kitchen, they found an item that wasn't supposed to be there.
It was an old pocket knife covered in dirt and blood, sitting in Anita's kitchen sink.
So let's talk about this scene right now at face value. Nothing missing. Anita covered. Stab wounds. You don't want to jump to any conclusions, but what are you thinking first off?
No, you know, anytime the victim is covered, that speaks volumes. You know, that generally indicates that the offender has some sort of personal connection to the victim. And that could just be in his mind. There may not even be a real connection. It may just be he's now killed somebody that he has a personal connection to and is covering up, not after the fact, not wanting to take a look at what he's done. You know, so there's that aspect that generally indicates now there might be a connection between the offender and the victim. So that's huge. That's very significant from a behavioral standpoint.
And there was no, when they investigate, they found no sexual assault. So what does that tell you?
You know, and that's so hard because you can have a sexually motivated crime, and we run into this all the time, and there's no evidence of sexual assault. You don't have semen being left behind. You don't have trauma to the victim's body, but it could still be a sexually motivated crime.
And when you think about a pocket knives usually aren't terribly sharp. I mean, some of them are, some of them aren't, but the force that you would have to use to stab somebody as opposed to a knife that, say, it's, you know, a knife that you're getting from a kitchen, say.
Yeah.
Or a butcher knife.
Even a dull knife, it doesn't take much to go through tissue. I mean, if you strike bone, you know, that's when the knife's, a sharper knife is actually going to, you know, do much better. But, you know, it really doesn't take much force. You think about stabbings with screwdrivers, right? They're not sharp, but the narrow, the limited surface area really intensifies the force that's applied. And it will just go right through the skin and right through tissue.
And what do you make of leaving the murder weapon behind?
Well, on one hand, in many ways, that's kind of smart by the offender. Because if the offender is caught escaping from a homicide scene and has the murder weapon on him, well, that's obviously very incriminating. If the murder weapon is something that can't be tracked back to the person, whether it be like, let's say, a gun that the offender doesn't have any connection to, that's actually a good thing because you're not risking having that evidence on your person and being associated with it. But if it's something that gives insight to the offender because it can be tracked back to him, like maybe it's a pocket knife that offender has been seen with by family, friends, coworkers, etc., then that's a big mistake.
So they look more closely at the screen from Anita's window, and it had clearly been slashed. But what was odd is that it had blood on it. And that left at least one detective to think that the window was a ruse, that it had been cut and placed there to look as if the killer had to break in to get to Anita, being that the front door was locked. But based on the blood present and the direction of the slash, the detective believed it was cut from the inside after Anita was already dead. So you've got this guy who is, you might say, okay, this seems like it's rage, but he covers her up. He leaves the knife, but before he leaves the knife, he tries to cover his tracks, which seems like a somewhat methodical thing to do that a rage killer wouldn't do, trying to cover up and trying to put this false lead to them, this red herring.
No, you know, if this is the case and this screen was cut after she was killed to make it look like somebody had tried to break in, this is staging. This is trying to stage the crime scene to look like something it's not. And anytime an offender does some form of staging, that's because the offender thinks that they naturally are going to be considered to be a suspect. Yeah. And so they try to misdirect law enforcement by making it look different. This is now looking like, well, somebody broke in. They didn't have access into the apartment.
Yeah. And we, you know, we spent about a year ago around this time, we spent a lot of time with a potentially staged crime scene down in San Diego with the Rebecca Zahao case.
Yeah.
And that was definitely one where we were looking at that, seeing, you know, there is a lot of potential staging going on.
No, that was a complex case, but I know my opinion is it was a staged, was a staged suicide.
Yeah. And obviously the reason why somebody would stage it like that is because if it was a homicide, where would police look?
Yeah.
And police, we know where police would look.
Yes.
In that case. So based on the evidence and Anita's body, investigators believe that she was killed in the early morning hours the day before. And, you know, Anita was very responsible. She would never just not show up. And since she didn't go to work on Saturday, time of death back then, time of death back in 2007. Has that changed at all since now, or is it also, it's all pretty good?
Well, you know, establishing time of death, you know, of course there's going to be establishing the victim's timeline. When was she last seen, last talked to? Entries, you know, into diaries, picking up newspapers. There's all sorts of things where you're looking at normal living aspects to try to figure out when she was still alive. But then time of death, when it comes to physical evidence, you know, the state of the body, you know, where is this body at? Rigor mortis, taking a look at how much rigor has formed or has rigor passed, insect evidence, if you have it. There's so many things that can be used, but it's always a very broad window. And there really isn't anything that has helped narrow that. And the longer somebody's been dead, the harder it is to determine, you know, a precise time of death. And there's all sorts of studies going on related to that. But the reality is you know, you can kind of get a sense whether, you know, it's a few hours or a few days or several weeks, et cetera. It's such large windows.
Have you seen time of death potentially be a big sort of red herring, in a sense where they thought the time and the investigators that were doing the case put the time at some point, but then it completely either screwed up the case for the detectives, and the detectives are like, that time of death couldn't be right. Does that happen?
Oh, no, it absolutely does happen. You know, and I just immediately thought of a case where, you know, a body was found. They're thinking we've got a homicide. This person had just recently died. And then as they go through their investigation, it turns out that, well, the person had died over 100 years ago. And they were so well preserved that it fooled everybody. It took an anthropologist to say, oh, hold on here. You know, you have oddities like that just because of, you know, what's going on within the environment or the embalming process. So their investigation began with those in close proximity to Anita and whoever had keys to the apartment. After talking to her parents, police learned that Anita and her roommate had been having some conflict in the apartment. According to her mother, Sharon, her roommate would bring men back to the apartment. Not necessarily cause for concern, but Anita said her roommate would often leave the apartment with the men still inside. She also told her mom that the roommate would send her threatening texts. Sharon didn't know the exact threats, but Anita told her mom she didn't feel safe and was afraid.
If it potentially was a, you know, we talk about female offenders, we're talking about a roommate sending threatening texts. You go back to the Faith Hedgepeth case, remember? You know, with feuding roommates and what potentially could happen there. Is that what could potentially motivate this type of killing? Because you immediately go to, and like you were saying, because there isn't evidence of a sexual assault doesn't mean it wasn't a sexually motivated assault.
Right.
So,
but at the same time, you can't say that in this particular case, let's say you have semen evidence. You know you've got a male.
Yeah.
In this case, what we've got is we don't have evidence of sexual assault. We have a female victim who's been stabbed and covered, and potentially a screen that was cut to stage it. So that starts pointing back to somebody very close to the victim. And of course, this most certainly could fit what a female offender, let's say a female roommate, could have done, you know, with this contentious relationship that she's having with the roommate. There's some motive there. Yeah. And now the roommate, if she did fly off and kill Anita, is trying to make it look like it's some intruder that has come in.
Yeah. And remember, you know, looking back at Faith Hedgepeth, the note and the, you know, there were so many different clues with Faith Hedgepeth, but that note, I'm not stupid, bitch, jealous, sounded like, and everybody that we've talked to and everybody that emailed us afterwards sounded like, would say that sounds like it was coming from a female and not a
woman.
Male.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Minot police confirmed that the two roommates had at least one physical altercation. And the fight included Anita's foot being slammed in the door. But as for killing Anita, well, the police said that the roommate had an alibi. She was across town with her parents all weekend.
Hmm.
You know, Minot has less than 50,000 people. It's about 17 square miles. How good of an alibi is that?
It's not. You know, when you're starting to look at the veracity of the alibi, you know, first, is it something that could be substantiated from some independent source, video surveillance, mm-hmm. you know, something where you can say, yes, I can see the roommate being here at this point in time when we believe the homicide occurred. Now, in this case, it's people, witnesses basically saying she was with us. Well, who are those people? Well, it's people who will protect her. It's her parents. I wouldn't put any faith in that alibi at all. So no boyfriends. Good family life. What about those who had access to the apartment? Law enforcement began looking at the workers at the complex, including the maintenance man who pointed out the window screen to Anita's dad. They took his DNA and questioned him, but he was never held. Then the police got a break, or so they thought. The Minot Police Department was contacted by a witness who saw a man running from the area on that Sunday morning. A sketch was released. Investigators hoped that the lead would pan out. But by the end of the day, the man was identified. He was a jogger who just happened to be in the area. Police then turned their focus to the roofers who had been working construction on the buildings in the complex. Over 40 different workers were interviewed. DNA was taken from some, but again, it was a dead end. Yeah. So, you know,
you got roofers, you know, and even the police department wasn't even sure if they got to all of them because many of the workers were day laborers.
Right.
So, which happens often in contractor jobs. So, you know, it's not like they can just go and pull employment files and see, you know, okay, this is this person's information. We got their social security number. We got their address. These are, you know, workers that were picked up and did the work, earned their money, and then left.
That's right. Yeah. You know, it's literally you get somebody, a contractor pulls into the Home Depot parking lot, you know, picks up 3, 4, 5 guys and has a job for them. And the reality is it's cash is exchanged. And they move on.
Yep. And in my opinion, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's, you know, for an investigation's sake, it can trip you up.
It makes it hard.
Yeah. So the police began to look at the relationships that Anita had. And one particular relationship, which according to her family was more of a friendship and possibly an unrequited love. It was her senior prom date, and his name was Tyler, and he definitely liked Anita. He considered her his best friend in high school and early in college, and he lived in the same apartment complex. His first interaction with police was the day her body was found in the police van. So Tyler actually came to the apartment while the police were there and was asking what's going on, you know? Yeah. He then was more than willing to talk with the police and give his DNA and do anything. He wanted to do anything to help with the investigation. And after that first day, police interviewed him a second time. And while they don't seem to think of him as a person of interest, Tyler hasn't stopped helping the investigation. He actually runs a Facebook remembrance page, and he continues to speak out in hopes of keeping attention on Anita's case. Now, we know that some offenders do insert themselves into investigations.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a point where, and we see this a lot, but particularly in the true crime space, as more and more people get into it, and more people that aren't necessarily journalists or former law enforcement, that they might attach themselves to cases that are close to them, which is great. And that's what we always talk about. We want people to do this, you know, but, because there is this history, the police have to look at him.
So, you know, this male Tyler, you know, when I look at him, you know, on one hand, absolutely, you could see this as being an innocent type of interaction. He lives in the same apartment complex. He's seeing police activity near where he has somebody he's very attached to. And of course, he's going to go over and say, hey, what's up? But at the same time, when I look at this crime scene, she was covered. that tells me that that offender is having issues with what was done to her. And somebody like a Tyler, who has a personal attachment to her, during a moment of rage, could have gone off the handle, killed her, and now is regretting it. And then there's that oh shit moment. I need to make this look like something it's not. And that's where the staging comes in. And that's where the slash in the screen to make it look like an intruder versus somebody she would let into the apartment could fit. Offenders do insert themselves, and law enforcement is aware of it. Mm-hmm. And so they do pay attention. And so that's why Tyler would start to be questioned as to, hey, you know, you're attached to her and you showed up.
Yeah. So Anita enjoyed going to downtown Minot to go dancing. And detectives went through every customer receipt at the clubs that she had gone to, but none of the patrons led them any closer to who could have killed Anita. And that was another dead end, and it wasn't long before the case was going cold. And there was a rumor in town that she had recently turned down someone at the bar, but that happens a million times. You know what I mean? It's just, it seems very much like it's a needle in a haystack, but you still got to... You got to follow every lead.
It's just tracking down all the possibilities, and those are always present.
Is that a big lead or no?
Well, they wouldn't. There's something going on right now. They've gotten some sort of really good lead at the moment, and I don't know what it is.
All right. So yeah. So, but very well, it might have been. You know, and that's the thing with whenever I have a case that I'm working on where the person was at a club. That something happened at a club. There's so many people taking pictures at clubs, doing selfies with their friends. There are so many surveillance videos around that it's ripe. I remember working this case with this guy who got into a fight at in a Boston bar right after a Yankees Red Sox game. So everybody's all liquored up. They're at this bar right outside of, it's called the Baseball Tavern. It's right outside of Fenway Park. And he gets kicked out of the bar because somebody stepped to him and there was an altercation. But then something happened in between when he left the bar, which is on the second floor, to the street. His head got cracked open and his life has changed forever. He can't function, you know, like himself. And I remember going through and searching, working with the family and searching for photographs of anybody that had been taken that night. So, and I got a lot of people that send them to me, but they also have party photographers. And the interesting thing about this case and this particular night was that every night on this night, which is a Saturday or a Sunday, they had posted about 100 pictures. You know, grip and grins is what they call them. Hey, you know what? I'm taking your picture, you know, and then they put them up on social, then people tag themselves and then it's way. That day, they didn't. So I went and found the photographer and I was like, listen, this is serious. I can understand why maybe because this happened, why the bar owners didn't want you to post this, but can you send them to me? And after some cajoling, he did. He sent them to me. Going through it over and over and over again and then talking to friends and stuff like that, we thought we probably found the guy who very well might have done this to this kid and changed his life forever. But we, you know, then the police did nothing. But still, it's just like there's so much, whenever you hear about that, especially in this day and age with so many people taking pictures, it was actually even a little bit better too, like 5 years ago before Snapchat and Insta stories, because a lot of those Insta stories, obviously they go away if they're taken within Instagram, but they are archived though. And, but you can't, I can't search them personally, but I was able to gather probably, I knew every person in that bar and that bar was packed. I mean, try to go into a bar outside of Fenway after a Yankees Red Sox game and it's going to be crazy.
Yeah.
And we were able to ID the guy. Unfortunately, there's still no justice there, but that's the Robbie McLaughlin case. But it's just, you know, when you have these cases where something might have happened or a individual might have met somebody at a bar, you do have you have the paper trails and you have a lot of photographs that can be looked through.
No, absolutely. And I'll just tell you again, I go back, you know, if she's, you know, been hit on by some random at a bar and he comes over and kills her, this crime scene would look very different. It would not be what we're talking about here.
Well,
and that's a subjective thing, but it's one of those things where it's like, no, I'm not feeling the bar right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Boston Strangler did cover some of his and his victims.
And that's where it comes into the offender's mindset, you know, in terms of what does he perceive.
Right.
What is his connection to that victim?
Right. But the, exactly. Yeah. But yeah. The slashing of the screen is such an odd red herring. You see this a lot with the breaking of a window, you know, where there's no glass on the inside. So, yeah, so somebody broke the window from the inside to make it look like somebody.
Well, and quite frankly, I know we've said the screen looks like it was slashed from the inside, but I'd want to see, have they had that screen examined by an expert to be able to determine that.
Well, they also had blood on it too. They were saying like the knife had the blood on it and then he cut the screen. And yeah. Why do that?
How was that blood distributed? Is that something? Because you could have an offender going back and touching that screen at various points in time. Mm-hmm. So I'd want to see how that blood was deposited. Does it look like it was deposited during, you know, let's say from a knife blade, or is it being deposited because he's deciding to you know, he's got bloody hands and is touching the screen when he's looking out of the window.
And, you know, there's another wrench to throw in this mix. So, remember the maintenance worker who found the screen?
Mm-hmm.
A year after the investigation, he killed himself. And that left some in the community to wonder if he could have been, maybe if he could have known more than the police actually realized.
Or been responsible.
Or been responsible for, you know. Michelle McNamara, who's the reason why we're partners on this podcast, she would always say it's always the handyman.
Yeah.
You know, there's I think there's a murderino that made a charm that said it's always the husband. And I read to her and I said, can you make it's always the handyman? And she did.
Oh, cool.
With a little shovel.
Yeah.
And, you know, it happens a lot, you know. It happened on True Detective Season 1. You know, and she was just like, she nailed it. She's like, it's always the handyman. But, you know, listen, a lot of people die by suicide, you know, every day, 45,000 in America every year. So you can't necessarily think that is, you know, that's reason, but that was the reason why, you know, he did that.
No, yeah, but at the same time, you know, he's the one that's pointing out the screen to law enforcement, saying, hey, look at that. It's almost as if he's like being the beacon, making sure law enforcement recognizes that's unusual.
Yeah.
Maybe he wanted them to say, oh, it looks like an intruder came in.
Yeah. So through the years, family and friends of Anita have continued to put pressure on the Minot Police Department. And when we cover the case at Crime Watch Daily, Minot PD couldn't confirm if all the DNA samples taken had indeed been tested, or if the DNA from the scene had even been put into CODIS. We've got so much of this DNA sitting in labs. This happened in 2007. What needs to happen to get it tested quickly? You were at a very forward-thinking department. You know, you were in a place, you had a lot of people from Berkeley and people that were, you know, at the top of their game. We're looking at this police department who had told us a couple, when did we do this story at Crime Watch?
2015
in the first season, who told us 8 years after this happened that they haven't, we don't even know if it's been tested yet. We don't know if it's been put into CODIS. And it's such a bullshit answer to get. And then you press them and then they toss the ball over the fence. And I know we harp on this a lot, and we harp on this with the rape kits and with when the companies and when the police departments say, okay, we cleared our rape kits, but what have you done after that? You better make sure all of those rape kits and those samples from those rape kits, the ones that are applicable, will go into CODIS. And then potentially after that, they should go into some sort of familial search. Which is why we've talked about that in the future, every police department or every major police department should have a genealogist to be able to track these guys down.
Yeah, you know, and when we start talking about, you know, what needs to happen to help labs out, you know, a lot of it is just in general with law enforcement. It's a sheer resource issue. There's so much that is flowing in, let's say, the DNA units within labs. What's happened is that the DNA technology has become so sensitive that investigators are submitting a ton of contact DNA type samples, and those often are very complex mixtures that take DNA analysts very long to figure out. They're just getting overrun. So it's a money issue. It's a resource issue. You need more people to be able to do it. But then when I hear that a department saying, we don't know, you know, well, they couldn't confirm if all the DNA samples taken had indeed been tested. Any crime scene, if you've collected multiple items out of a crime scene, you could have hundreds of different surfaces that you could swab for DNA samples. You make an intelligent decision on what you think is going to be the most probative, mm-hmm. and you go after it. And then whether or not a sample qualifies to be uploaded into CODIS is a different thing entirely.
Yeah.
And right now, based on, you know, at least with what we've got, we don't know if they have any probative DNA evidence in this case. They have a victim where they're saying there was no sexual assault. So that tells me they don't have semen evidence. Mm-hmm. They don't have saliva evidence that would indicate there had been sexual contact. Have they pursued doing, contact DNA? Did they take blind swabs from Anita's body?
Yeah.
The screen, contact DNA off the screen, the knife. There's so many things that you could go after.
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff.
Yes. I have one case, Anne Vorey case, an older woman that was raped and killed inside her house in Lafayette. And I went out there with a couple of criminalists and basically said, you're swabbing. She was fully clothed. Swabbing. They came back with 85 swabs just from her body alone. Mm-hmm. And we ended up getting the offender's DNA from her, I think it was her right nipple. And that hidden code is to a guy out of Mississippi. And he turned out to be a magazine salesperson who happened to be in the area at the time of her homicide.
What do you think the percentage is right now that they're doing the full body swabs?
Oh, it's limited. Most of the cases that I review across the nation, if they think it's sexual assault, they collect a sex kit. Where you see good sampling happening is either with crime labs that are sending criminalists out that also handle crime scenes, like out of my old agency, the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Office, or highly trained SART nurses who are dealing with living rape victims, and they have received the training to understand that they need to do these types of blind swabs, even from living victims. And again, huge success. So cases can be solved with those blind swabs, and cases could end up remaining unsolved because that type of swabbing is not being done.
And so in 2016, Friends of Anita presented a petition to the police department asking for extra resources to be brought in. And they accepted the petition, but it's still unclear if the help was ever brought in.
Just this summer, family and friends bought out the digital billboards around the fair in Minot for 2 weeks asking for information. Upon talking with the police department ourselves, we've learned that there are two new detectives on the case. The hope is that with these two new eyes, they will be able to bring insights that may have been overlooked in the past.
You know, and this case has ripple effects like they all do. And we told you about the maintenance man who died by suicide. But Anita's brother died by suicide via gunshot in 2013. Yeah. And it's because he couldn't cope with his sister's death. And Anita's father says that the killer stole two of their children. And this is what happens. You know, it's the victim first and foremost, but then what this person takes, and this is the reason why I know I do what I do, is because how dare that person take a life away. And then you see that first and how dare them, but then see that ripple effect. And yeah. It's devastating.
No, you know, in many ways, the family experiences like a life sentence as a result of the killer's actions. And, you know, the victim has lost their life, but then the family has lost their loved one. And the experiences that they would have had with a loved one for the rest of their lives. And then they have the emotional trauma for the rest of their lives out of that loss.
So here's our weekly assignment. We're hoping that the Minot Police Department will let us help facilitate whatever help they need with the DNA in Anita's case. But beyond that, we're looking for anyone with information on Anita's case. So even if you think the police already have the information, please reach out. It's been 12 years. And there are new eyes on the case. And whenever you have new eyes on the case, it's a good thing. Because they see it as a challenge. They don't see it as something that they've already gone through. Maybe a new or revisited tip is all that is needed to solve what we think is a solvable case. So again, we'll give you the rules. No naming names in public, no doxing, just be nice to each other. And this is a case that I really think that we could get some traction on and is going to resonate with people. And we're going to stay on this. The Minot Police Department, if you need those extra resources, please come to us. We will give you those resources, as along with any other police department. We never want to hear any police department say, we don't have the resources to run this DNA or do a familial search. That should not be an excuse. And come to us, and we will help. We will pay for it.
Yeah, you know, and maybe one of the things that I will chime in a little bit about the use of the term the familial search. So that generally is something that we use in law enforcement when we are doing a familial search within CODIS versus doing the forensic genetic genealogy, as it's being called today. So it's kind of one of those, I don't know, semantics.
Right.
But that's just something.
You guys would use the term familial.
Familial.
So familial was within CODIS. And then when you're talking about genealogical, that was when we would get the whole genome and we were talking about, okay, all right, I need to stop using that then. Because we use familial throughout this third part of I'll Be Gone in the Dark, too. So,
oh, yeah.
We will change that. All right. It's weekly distraction time. We are firmly into the holiday season. So, Paul, we are drinking tonight from Whistle Pig Straight Rye Whiskey, 15 year, who was given to you by Yardley Smith from Small Town Dicks.
Yes.
Who is also, she plays Lisa Simpson on The Simpsons. We just went to a lovely party at her house. She has a speakeasy inside of her house, which basically is a squad goal right now. And me and Paul have looked at it and said, you know what? We need that.
Absolutely.
but the thing about you, so, Yardley, tweeted at me and I tweeted her back and I put the hashtag fair is fair. Because while I love The Simpsons, my favorite thing that Yardley has ever done is a movie called The Legend of Billie Jean. And it's an amazing movie, very 80s, great soundtrack, Pat Benatar, Billy Idol. It's about a kid who gets his I guess it was a scooter stolen or a moped stolen. And they screw it all up by these rich kids in the town. His sister tries and goes and gets the money for the scooter. She's assaulted by the owner of the dad of the guy she was trying to get the money from. And then the guy's accidentally shot by her and her brother. And then they go on the run.
Huh.
And it becomes this big thing. And there's a lot of Joan of Arc imagery in there. And it's just a great, very empowering movie. And Yardley's in it. And she's so great in it. So I implore you out there, because I started rewatching it again, to watch The Legend of Billie Jean.
Wow. Well, you know what? I didn't know she was in that. I've heard of that movie. I've never seen it.
Oh, it's great.
I didn't know she was in it. So that's fun. One of the interesting things about Yardley that I've learned as I've gotten to know her and Dan and Dave from Small Town Dicks is that Yardley and I listen to the same kind of music when we work out. She is in, believe it or not, she is into that hard, hard rock.
So the Five Finger Death Punch?
Five Finger Death Punch along that spectrum. Yeah. So we've talked about, well, hey, maybe we need to kind of work out together. That'd be kind of fun.
All right. What's your distraction?
Oh, you know, I was thinking about this because this is always just such a tough thing for me to come up with. And this is maybe going to be TMI, but shaving. I know. Here I go. I like to shave in the shower. right? That is just so convenient. You know, you're just there. You just lather it up. I have a little mirror that's hanging on my shower wall, and I can just sit there and shave. But when I'm traveling, I don't have that, you know, and I'm finding, you know, sometimes what I'll, you know, going to the sink after I get out of the shower to shave is such a pain in the ass. And so I've tried to sit there and, you know, okay, I'll be in the hotel shower. And if I can see the mirror, can I kind of just duck down below the fog line so I can shave in the shower? Well, I finally invested in a quality electric razor. And oh my God, that has been life changing. So now I can shave multiple times a day while I'm sitting there watching TV. And it does. I mean, these nice razors do a good job. Nice electric razors do a good job. You know, and every now and then I'll have to use a real razor. But it's like, wow, why didn't I do this before? So I'm actually kind of happy at that. It's not a disaster. I'm not being attacked by an animal.
Multiple times per day, you're just shaving while you're watching TV?
Well, it just depends on the day. Do you realize how many showers I take a day? I mean, sometimes I'll take 4 showers a day. I like to be clean. And again, maybe that's TMI.
Or maybe that's what the people want. So that is Murder Squad. We'll leave you with that. Again, we've got some new merch in the merch store, so go check it out. Check us out on social. There'll be information about this case and all of our other cases. Please be safe out there during this holiday season. We would love for you to leave a review. And you can subscribe to us on Spotify, on iTunes, everywhere, Stitcher. You can follow us on social at Billy Jensen, at Paul.Holes, and at Jensen and Holes. And we will talk to you next week. So keep digging.
Keep digging.
And don't be an irony.
Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Paulie Katowski. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgariff, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.